Hi, people. How's it going? I just wanted to take a moment to remember Gene Barry, who died recently. Good character actor. Did a wide range of things. He did westerns, of course. He did western TV shows. He did movies. He did some contemporary TV shows. And he also played the gay, less campy husband in the first English language version of the musical of La Cage aux Folles. So he had a pretty wide-ranging career. I remember him from things like War of the Worlds and Bat Masterson and Amos Burke's Secret Agent and Burke's Law, of course, and Name of the Game and The Adventurer and a whole bunch of other TV series. Very cool guy. His heart was in the right place. He was on the side of the angels. And just to celebrate the life of Gene Barry, I'm going to play the theme tune from one of his TV shows instead of the usual theme that we play for Paleo Cinema. And then we'll get into looking at the career and life of Warren Oates, who, curiously enough, starred in a TV show with Gene Barry once upon a time, an episode of Bat Masterson. So here it is, the theme from Bat Masterson. My name's Terry Frost, and welcome to Paleo Cinema.
Back when the West was very young, there lived a man named Masterson.
Definitely a blast from the past. How are you, people? We're doing okay here. If I'm a little more relaxed this time around with the podcast, it's because I'm just finishing off a frozen strawberry daiquiri. And yes, the sun's over the yard, so I'm not really doing it ahead of time. I'm not going to end up like Ray Milland in The Lost Weekend or anything like that. Very rarely drink. And just wanted something cool. And we had a bucket full of frozen strawberry daiquiris in the freezer, so therefore I have availed myself of it. So what's been happening? I did see a few movies recently, as always. A lot of Warren Oates movies, of course, because we're going to be talking about him in just a moment. I did see The Informant, the Matt Damon movie directed by Steven Soderbergh. I'm not going to talk too much about that because I've written a review of it for the Cool Shot on the Tube podcast people. They're going to put that up on their website at some stage, so you might want to take a look at it there. Been watching a bunch of other stuff as well. Nothing really jumped out. Haven't seen Avatar yet, unlike a few friends of mine who've seen previews of it. Definitely looking forward to that. I don't particularly like James Cameron as a filmmaker. I think he's probably his best film so far was Piranha 2. But I'm interested in, of course, changes in film technology and different ways of telling a story using the technologies. So I'm looking forward to that. I'll probably catch up with a few friends just around Jingle Bells time. And the other thing I should mention is I am going to squeeze another podcast in before the reindeer shit on your roof. So it's now, let me have a look at the date because I've totally forgotten the date here. The Sunday the 13th, so I will squeeze another one in before the 25th. Not sure what it's going to be. It's going to be the usual Newton Mass kind of thing. Find something a bit different to do with it and do it. So guess what? We have got letters. We got emails this time around, and thank you very much for everybody who dropped a line saying they're enjoying the podcast. I'll save the emails till the end of the podcast, and just at the moment what I'll do is I'll get Sal to do the usual intro thing and get back, and we'll have a look at the United States of Warren Mercer Oates.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. K kultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
I don't know, it's locked. Well, I'll tell you what's in it. We got about 5 kilos of shit, about 3 lids of hash, about 8 ounces of cocaine, some reds, some uppers,
what's
some downs.
What's in it?
Well, an 8x10 glossy of Robert Goulet.
Okay, let's jump right in the deep end. This is Paleo Cinema Podcast 41. I'm calling it the United States of Warren Oates after the great song by Dave Graney and the Coral Snakes from their 1994 album, The Lure of the Tropics, where Dave wrote a song just basically eulogizing Warren Oates and kind of comparing his life with the life Dave was leading in Melbourne at the time. There are a few contemporary references to a place called the Chat and Chew, which used to exist on Swanston Street in Melbourne. It was a little cafe called the Chat and Chew where you could go in and get steak and eggs and have a cup of coffee and things like that and just watch the world go by. The Chat and Chew's not there anymore. Like a lot of good things in life, there are some things that have their day and then suddenly fade into memory, fond memory. And the Chat and Chew for Dave Graney obviously was one of those. So, back to Warren Oates. Movies aren't like real life. In movies, the most beautiful people are or they become paragons of virtue and lovableness and sometimes our sexual fantasies. In real life, beauty all too often hides an internal ugliness. In movies, the veneer of a depth of character is what we get. We don't actually get a reality of depth of character. Most movie actors are concerned with their image and how they're perceived by the punters. Warren Oates was not one of those people. He was an exception. I mean, Warren Mercer Oates was a poor Kentucky boy born in 1928, and he was an actor who died early. He was 52 at the time he died, which is the age I am now, so maybe there's a resonance there for me. And in his career, he played all sorts of characters. He played a racist safe cracker, an astronaut who becomes a super intelligent mutant, a comedic drill sergeant, a legendary but ultimately stupid bank robber, a crazy charter boat captain in the Florida Keys who has his own skewed sense of honour, several bushwhacking cowpokes, a bartender in Mexico who falls in love with a prostitute and travels on a quest for a better life that ends up in a personal hell, and a lonely man driving Route 66, picking up hitchhikers and telling each one of them a different story about his life. He was an actor who was never going to play a corporate CEO or a patrician New Englander. He essayed marginal men who sweated and drank too much and did foolish things more often than they did wise ones. Now, the naturalness that Warren Oates brought to these roles made the job of bringing these characters to life look much easier than it was. In movie making with a crew of dozens around you, naturalness isn't natural. Getting into the gut of a character while technicians watch your every nuance takes really focus and dedication. Warren Oates definitely had that. He was never going to be a big star, but he did become an iconic actor. The title character in Dillinger and Benny the Piano Player and Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia and GTO in Tulane Blacktop and the stunted, dangerous nickel dance in Tom McGuane's 92 in the Shade are all different characters, but all of them work together to make the mental image that I have of Warren Oates. So I'm going to kind of deliver what's kind of like a taster's plate of Warren Oates' roles. He was a star in only 4 movies. Cockfighter in Tulane Blacktop, which were directed by Monty Hellman, John Milius' Dillinger, and, of course, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, directed by Sam Peckinpah. But he was in a whole range of other films, too, some good and some bad, but Oates himself was never really bad in a movie. He was a jobbing actor, and when the director let him, he gave more than full value for the money he was paid. The first clip I'm going to play from Warren Oates' career is from a forgotten film from 1975 called 92 in the Shade. It was directed and written by Tom McGuane, based on the first of his very popular novels. And it's quite a flawed film. Everything's shot in kind of mid shots. and the direction's pretty shit because the guy who directed it was the writer, so in a sense it was a bit of a vanity project. And the story is basically Peter Fonda plays a young son of a rich family who decides he wants to be a fishing boat, charter boat captain. And he's the experienced charter boat people down in Florida Keys play a little bit of a trick on him when he's off the boat untangling a fishing line from a mangrove swamp. They sneak up and steal the people that he's the guide for, and he spends the whole day looking for them. And he kind of snaps after that. He realizes that a character called Nickel Dance, which is a fantastic name, played by Warren Oates, and his mate, played by Harry Dean Stanton, so the casting in this is fantastic, stole the people just as a way of kind of bringing him down a peg or two. Now, the Peter Fonda character in this, being a rich boy, basically can't handle that. He's never had this kind of a confrontation before. So he burns Nickel Dance's charter boat to the ground. They're flat boats. They're off on the around the Keys and the Everglades, so they don't really need to be deep sea kind of fishing boats. They're little flat boats. And Nickel Dance kind of goes on a down and swears to the character Peter Fonda's playing that if he becomes a charter boat captain again, Nickel Dance will shoot him in the gut. And it becomes a point of honor for the Nickel Dance character that he does that. And he's on a bit of a downer. He can't play his trade because his boat's been burnt. And here's a bit of dialogue between the Nickel Dance character and Harry Dean Stanton, playing another one of the charter boat captains. Just discussing the options that Nickel has for the future.
Nickel, you ain't going soft, are you? Maybe so. I mean, now that you're out of it, what do you think you're going to do? Caddy. I'm going to be Arnold Palmer's caddy. I'll wear a V-neck sweater and I'll live by myself. At night, I'll jack off in a hanky. It'll be a simple life, but it'll be complete. Arnold wins a Masters and I'll get a Buick convertible for a tip. Come on, Nick. See me and Marlo just like that. I'll know every club he wants before he asks for it.
Yeah, that's real funny.
What the hell do you care?
Well, I mean, it's just insulting, you know. I mean, you did forbid him to guide, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Then how come James Powell is building him a guide boat?
Is that true?
Uh-huh.
Well, I didn't know that. I sure didn't.
Yeah. I mean, now you can't get one built. He's gonna guide.
Well, look. I didn't forbid him to build a skiff. But I sure didn't know that.
What the hell you think he's gonna do with it? Pull crab pots?
I don't know. I gotta let him hang himself. This is a democracy, and democracy, you know what democracy does, don't you?
No, what does democracy?
Democracy moves on. It marches on. Democracy marches on.
Shit, man, I don't know about you. I mean, really, what are you afraid of his granddaddy? Is that it? I mean, it looks to me like he is going to guide when he gets his skiff built. Then what are you going to do?
I'm going to shoot him. Where's your memory?
Like I said, not a great film, but it's worth watching only, probably, for Warren Oates in one of his better roles. The other parts of the cast, the other casting's pretty good. I mean, Burgess Meredith's in this film, William Hickey's in this film, Margot Kidder, Elizabeth Ashley, Sylvia Miles, who people remember from Warhol's movies. They're all in this, but with a better director, it would have been a much better film. Apparently, there was a lot of chaos in the life of Thomas McGuane at the time. He was married to Elizabeth Ashley and having an affair with Margot Kidder, and basically his whole life went to shit for a few number of years after the making of this film. So the backstory in some ways is much more interesting than the film itself. And I think one of the big problems is Peter Fonda's just that little bit too old to play the character he's supposed to be playing. He's more of a contemporary age with the guys he's supposed to be playing the junior to. But check it out if you can find it. It's on VHS rather than DVD at the moment, so you may find it in the usual places that you find DVD, well, AVI copies of VHS tapes. But very much worthwhile just for that Warren Oates role. One of the things that Oates did really well was play stupid men. Not because he himself was stupid, but he understood the stubbornness and the recalcitrance and the self-destructive pride of some kinds of stupid men. And in that, he portrayed them much better than anybody else. The other film where he plays... I watched Tulane Blacktop for the first time not too long ago, and I'm very impressed with it. Monty Hallman was always a bit of an iconoclastic and individual filmmaker. And the story is basically two stock car racers traveling across America, going from race to race. They're played by Dennis Wilson, one of the Beach Boys, and James Taylor, the musician. And neither of them, as an actor, James Taylor makes a good singer, and Dennis Wilson makes a good drummer for the Beach Boys. But this movie's basically stolen by a third character, GTO, played by Warren Oates. It's a guy in a Ford GTO traveling around the same path as these guys, picking up hitchhikers, telling them all a different story about his life, and basically he seems to be a lost man. He's got a disconnect somewhere in his past, and it's never explicitly laid out in the script, but you can tell by the lies he tells about his life and the travelling he does that there's some kind of trauma in his past. You don't need to know what it is for it to work, but the character is a fascinating one and basically steals the film away from the other two people. I'll just play a little soundbite from that just to give you a bit of an idea about GTO. He's just picked up a guy hitchhiking, a kind of chubby guy who is clutching a briefcase to his chest for some reason, never explained. And they're just talking while they're in the car together.
Thank God almighty, mister.
She's got a hard pull, doesn't she? 0 to 60 in 7.5. She'll do a quarter of a mile, 13.40. Performance and image, that's what it's all about.
It's a mighty fancy automobile.
I bought her in Bakersfield, California. I was testing jets at the time. Well, it got so I wasn't getting enough action on the ground. You know what I mean. I mean, you just can't stay with the same high forever.
So when a 455 came out with a Mark IV Ram Air and a B-floor in, a Carter high-riser setup,
I was online.
390 horsepower, 500 foot-pounds of torque.
Whatever that is.
It's all in the folder right there in the glove compartment if you want to take a look at it. Oh, she's a real road king, all right.
How come you ain't still in Bakersfield?
Because I'm in the Southwest. What kind of sounds you like?
Beg pardon?
Rock, soul, hillbilly, western. What's your taste?
It don't hardly matter to me.
That bit of dialogue kind of harks back to what I was mentioning about Pinter's dialogue last time around. The things being said are not being said by the words, but they're being said behind the words in a way. And GTO is a very lonely person. You get that strong impression watching the movie that he's lonely. He's very chatty with his hitchhikers. He's lost. He's cut adrift from the culture in a weird way. And Warren Oates portrays that beautifully in the pauses, but in the dialogue and in the sidelong looks he gives people and things like that. The films of Warren Oates, where he's in the scene, really do reward you for paying close attention, for just taking that little bit of time to look a little more deeply into it and see the nuances. And they're not accidental either. There's a great documentary called Warren Oates Across the Border, which was made in about 1993. And one of the recurring things that people say about Oates is that he had a very intellectual approach to acting. He never spoke about it. He did a lot of research. He did a lot of careful noting and things like that. What seemed accidental or just instinctive was well planned out by him. He was a very intelligent man and an intelligent actor who brought to the screen the art of playing people that weren't necessarily as intelligent as he was. And GTO is definitely one of those kind of people. After having seen that documentary, I really went back and I watched a couple more of his films, and I noticed that. I noticed the carefulness and the openness of Warren Oates' acting. He doesn't have that thing that actors sometimes have where they're protecting themselves. They're not actually showing themselves raw with their emotions. They're not showing a bit of themselves when they do it. They're pretending to be somebody else, and they're not bringing the guts of themselves into the acting role. But Warren Oates did that. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Dillinger, one of the other starring roles that he had. And then I'm going to talk about the film where this kind of part of Warren Oates as an actor most came out. And that, of course, is Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, which is probably his most iconic role and his best role.
The producers would like to remind you that if the frank portrayal of sex offends you, please do not attend this film.
Just found an interesting thing that David Thompson, the movie critic and scholar, wrote about Warren Oates in his biographical dictionary of film. I'll just read it out to you because it's pretty cool. Oates seemed at first sight grubby, balding and unshaven. You can smell whiskey and sweat on him, along with that mixture of bad beds and fallen women. He's toothy, he's small, he's 53 this year, and he has a face like prison bread, with eyes that have known too much solitary confinement. But the eyes bulge and shrink in a sweet game of fear and courage. Sublimest thing with Oates is when he does nothing. Only Mitchum could do nothing so well, until you think of a hole, that a hole is opening up in the middle of the picture and everything is going to fall down into it. Then you see Oates start that shy grin of his, and you shake yourself because he could have been dead. The greatest trick in writing about Oates is to catch the spirit of obituary. Now, David Thompson wrote that about 6 months before Warren Oates died in 1982. So he had that kind of fatalism about Oates and about the kind of character that he portrayed. The exception to this, most of all, is probably Dillinger. The film that Oates made with John Milius, it starred Ben Johnson as Melvin Purvis, the G-man who was chasing Dillinger. You got Harry Dean Stanton in it. The cast is just terrific. You got Harry Dean Stanton, Steve Canale's in it, Richard Dreyfuss playing Babyface Nelson, Michelle Phillips playing his girlfriend. Just a terrific ensemble. Every now and then you'll see somebody pop up and you go, wow. And towards the end of the film, there's a weird kind of phenomenon with it where pretty much all of the big 1930s gangsters get great death scenes. I mean, Steve Canale's character, Pretty Boy Floyd, gets a death scene in a paddock. The character played by Harry Dean Stanton gets one of the coolest death scenes I've seen in a while. And the one that Warren Oates gets as Dillinger is kind of understated because it's, you know, walks out of the Biograph cinema, turns the corner with the two girls, bam, Melvin Purvis shoots him with a machine gun. So it's a kind of understated thing. But Oates in that role was kind of understated more than he has been in a lot of films. And he portrays the stupidity of Dillinger believing his own publicity. Selling newspapers was important in the 30s. It was depression. People wanted news. People lived vicariously. It was probably the first time that that kind of voyeurism of the media came into play with radio and newspapers. And the gangsters were a big part of that. And the Dillinger that you see with Warren Oates kind of bought into that. He started believing his own PR, which was ultimately his downfall. And that's a quite a divergent role, but it's quite an intelligent role for Oates as well. He, the script is kind of weird in a way. It dates back kind of to the Untouchables kind of thing. And you have Ben Johnson's Melvin Purvis character doing voiceover narration. The interesting thing about that is Ben Johnson was roughly twice as old as the real Melvin Purvis was at the time all this occurred. So he was played as a much older man, a big beefy character, where actually Purvis himself was called Little Melvin because he was such a short guy. and he was in his 30s at the time, and Ben Johnson would have had to be hitting 60 at the time. So history doesn't seem to play too much of a part in some of the casting for this film. And of course, Ben Johnson had just won an Academy Award, so maybe that's why he got the role. He had the best supporting character role in The Last Picture Show. So maybe that explains it. But his character is much larger and seems to... And it's probably one of Ben Johnson's best roles as well. But the Dillinger is very understated. He's personable, he's friendly, interesting character, but ultimately it was one of those roles where Oates was in some ways permitted to bring what he had to the party, but it wasn't a quite a typical role for him. He did it very well, but it's kind of off to one side of his career in some ways. I'll just give you a little bit of a soundbite from that movie.
What are you smiling at me for like that, young man? I don't believe I know you.
No, ma'am, but whenever I see money, I smile that way. You got a nice smile too, miss. I'd like to withdraw my entire account.
Your entire account?
Yes, ma'am, the whole thing.
And your name?
John. John Dillinger.
All right, everybody, hold it right where you are. This is a robbery. Charlie, get that back vault. Harry, clean off the counters.
Watch them, Homer. Watch them.
No.
Everybody on your stomachs now. I said I mean it now. You miss. Turn over. This ain't no board directors meeting.
Get in there.
Don't nobody get nervous. You ain't got nothing to fear. You're being robbed by the John Dillinger gang. That's the best there is. These few dollars you lose here today, they're going to buy you stories to tell your children, your great-grandchildren. This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
One of the things I like about Oates Dillinger is the fact that he's not particularly a good-looking guy, of course, because Oates himself wasn't. But he's one of those not-too-good-looking guys who tries to make do on charm. He becomes more charming to compensate for the fact that he's toothy and not good-looking and balding and all the rest of it. And I think Oates brought a bit of himself to that. He was apparently quite a charismatic and charming guy. He'd been through rough patches. He was born very poor. His family had to move to Louisville when he was very young because of the Depression. And he spent a lot of years, so from the 50s till late 60s, just as a jobbing actor. He must have done every TV Western between about 1958 and 1968. I went through the filmography of Warren Oates in those early years, and a lot of my favorite TV Westerns are here. I'll just read you through a bunch of them. Let's see what we've got. I'll just kind of go backwards. He was in The Big Valley. He was in TV series as Shane, The Munros, The Virginian. He was in an episode of Lost in Space. He was in Rawhide, TV series of 12 O'Clock High, A Man Called Shenandoah, Branded. Major Dundee was in that movie as well. The Rounders, The Fugitive, The Outer Limits, of course, and Twilight Zone. Stoney Burke, he was the sidekick to Jack Lord in the TV series Stoney Burke. He was one of the villains in Ride the High Country. He was in Bonanza, The Untouchables, The Rifleman, Have Gun, Will Travel, Bat Masterson, Laramie, Wanted Dead or Alive. He was in an episode of Hawaiian Eye and The Lawman. I mean, he did a lot of work there, and he didn't particularly see himself as a Western actor. He kind of had a bit of a problem with being perceived as that. I'll give you a quote. Hopalong Cassidy and Ben Johnson have rubbed out on my life. That's about all I have to say. I feel most uncomfortable in a Western role because my image of the Western man is John Wayne, and I'm just a little shit. Basically, that's how he saw himself in Western roles. And I think ultimately, though some people have said that he was very comfortable playing period characters, he was one of those people that brought a verisimilitude to Western roles because he looked like those gruffy, undernourished people that they had in the West in the 19th century. Which, of course, leads us to the most iconic film of Warren Oates' career, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, directed by Sam Peckinpah. Peckinpah was a difficult guy to get along with. He alienated his friends and then went to outrageous lengths to try to placate them afterwards. And the legend and the stories of Peckinpah are numerous. I've got to find a decent biography of Sam Peckinpah. If anybody wants to throw one my way, I'd be happy to accept it. It's he's an interesting character, basically because of those flaws in his character. And Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia is in some ways one of Peckinpah's most personal films. He showed in that movie the Mexico you don't see in Hollywood films. He showed the poor side of it. He showed the little cantinas where, to take a piss, you went behind a scrappy old piece of wooden board to in the main room of the bar and took a piss into a hole in the wall. And he showed the little bars and cantinas and where the poor people lived in Mexico better than any film up to that time. There are parts of the movie that are documentary in just the choice of location. But anyway, I'm going to just play two clips of what a couple of people from the documentary Warren Oates Across the Border had to say about Warren Oates in Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. The first one's from the actor and writer Robert Culp, who wrote a very good essay on Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. But here's what he's got to say about Alfredo Garcia.
Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia was the most perfect metaphoric story for Peckinpah I had ever seen or that anybody could dream of. And here it was up on the screen and it didn't work. It was crap. And I said, oh God, what happened? How could this be? And I looked at it more carefully, of course, and he had taken Warren and it's as if he had tied little threads, little invisible threads around his elbows and all of his fingers and his eyelids and tried to make him into Sam Peckinpah.
It's an interesting viewpoint on the movie. I disagree with it, and I'll explain why after I play the next clip. But the next clip is actually from David Thompson, the movie scholar, talking about Warren Oates in Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia.
I don't see it as a realistic story. I see it as a fable. I see it as a fable about a kind of forlorn, fatalistic, redeeming mission that this really scruffy, jerky guy can take on to give himself something at the end of life. I think it's one of his best films. And it's obviously crucial if you like Oates because it's really the only film he ever carried as a star. It's a star part. And he doesn't let it down, far from it. I think he gets more interesting as the film goes on.
I've got a lot of respect for Robert Culp as an actor and also as a writer, but I disagree with him in this time. And I'll tell you why. I think that the puppet metaphor doesn't work because Warren Oates was so raw in that film. In Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, he is emotionally raw. There's no artifice, there's no actorly tricks, there's no artificiality in what he brings to the screen in this film. The romance between Benny, the piano player, and the character played by Isila Vega, his prostitute girlfriend, is a kind of doomed, fatalistic romance between two people in their 30s or 40s who are damaged people, and they come together, and there's a lyric, elegiac kind of feel to it, which is incredibly touching, and the tenderness between the two characters who have more sharp edges than is possible. I mean, it's quite a touching role, and the ultimate tragedy of it is made so much more tragic because both Isila Vega and Warren Oates were so emotionally open in that film. It's an action film in a weird way with a heart. It's, you know, gory and ugly and feudal and people in a landscape where they're being hunted down by a couple of bounty hunters played by Gig Young and Robert Webber, who it's implied are a homosexual couple, and also by various other people who are going after the $1 million for bringing El Jefe, the head of Alfredo Garcia, who knocked up his daughter. And it's A weird thing. I mean, action films don't usually have a heart this deep, but for Peckinpah, this was a very personal project. Even though the original script isn't his, he personalized the project to a great degree. And even though, but from the look that Warren Oates has in this film, he's obviously supposed to be a substitute for Peckinpah himself. Most of us never met Sam Peckinpah the way people like Robert Culp did. Robert Culp worked with Peckinpah on TV westerns in the 1950s. So he had professional dealings with Sam Peckinpah. But for us as viewers, yeah, we know Peckinpah. We know what Peckinpah looked like. We've seen the photos. We know all that kind of stuff. But that distance that an audience rather than a professional has from Sam Peckinpah allows us to see Warren Oates in the role without that kind of pre-knowledge blurring the boundaries between the two people. And I think as Warren Oates, I rewatched this film yesterday and it blew me away again. It didn't blow me away because of the landscape. It didn't blow me away because of the music or the cinematography or the wonderful framing that Peckinpah and his director of photography put the film in. Somebody once said that you can take any frame of this film and it makes a beautiful picture, and that's correct. But it's not that that grabbed me. It's the tragedy of the film in a weird way. It's the passion that Warren Oates brought. I mean, maybe he had a sense that this was going to be his big starring role. Maybe he had that feeling about the film. Or maybe he trusted Peckinpah enough to be as raw as he is in this film. It's quite an extraordinary piece of cinema, and I think the large share of that extraordinariness comes from Warren Oates. Yeah, the script is fantastic and Peckinpah's direction is fantastic, but Oates in the centre of that film, it's really one of those pieces of acting that doesn't come along very often. There are a number of other ones I could compare it to in the quality of it, in the excellence of it, not the quality, but the excellence of it. But there is no character in cinema like Benny in Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. It's a unique construction and collaboration between these people. It didn't come from a big name actor. It didn't come from somebody who had a great history of playing star roles, of going through the studio system and being seen in nightclubs with beautiful women and having gossip columns talking about his love life or anything like that. It came from a jobbing actor. It came from a good character actor that people knew he was great at it, but he didn't look like a star. And maybe that's why it works. Maybe that's part of it. The fact that Isela Vega isn't like a 22-year-old popsy and that Warren Oates looks like he fits inside a bar in Mexico, knocking back drinks and thinking about the past, that makes this work. If you haven't seen that film, or if you haven't seen it recently, definitely revisit it and just... I'd turn the sound off for watching some parts. I wound them back and turned the sound off and just watched the acting without the dialogue. And Warren Oates' face conveys what's happening in the scene tremendously well, as indeed does Isela Vega, excellent actress. There are so many good scenes, but that one scene where the two bikies, played by Chris Christopherson and Sonny Fritz, I think it is, are going to rape Elita, the Isela Vega character, and she turns and says something to Benny, which I'm not going to even spoil it for you by trying to convey it. I could grab the sound clip, but you have to see it in context. There have been millions of words written about this film, but it's not about the words in the film. It's about the journey. It's about the way that Benny gets from being a very passive character to being the ultimate man of action in an ultimately a tragic and redeeming way. I'll just play a little bit from the beginning of the film where Benny meets the two bounty hunters played by Gig Young and Robert Webber, just to give you a little feel for the film.
Buenas noches.
Hola, guapo.
Something
for the ladies.
Burrow piss?
Come on, what do you want to hear?
Who knows? What would you like?
How about, I Remember April?
I Remember April.
Yeah.
You hear me?
What's that?
Oh, it's just an old song.
Now, how about buying you a drink?
Great.
Give me a double Jack Daniels on the rocks. We got a live one here.
Take me to your leader. Well, salutis pesetas, hear more. They like that beer. You know, they brought German burgomasters over here back in about 1800 and something. Who knows, a long time ago.
¿Quieres conmigo?
Some of the best beer in the world comes from Mexico.
I've been thinking a bit about why I like this film better than I like The Wild Bunch, which, of course, Juarez was also in. And I think it's the fact that it's a more focused film. With The Wild Bunch, you've got a number of different characters. But this film's kind of pared down from that to tell pretty much the same kind of philosophical story that Peckinpah told in The Wild Bunch, that end of an era, that sadness, that kind of macho tristesse about being a man. And The Wild Bunch, you've got William Holden, you've got Robert Ryan, you've got all those other characters, Ernest Borgnine, all the rest of them in there. But when Peckinpah zooms down to it being the film being about a single man and where he goes, I think it's intensified in a lot of ways. Peckinpah made a couple of films after this one, one of which I'm inordinately fond of, way beyond the quality of the film. It's a film called Killer Elite with James Caan and, again, Gig Young in it, which is a kind of Japanese samurai film done as a corporate CIA spy film, in a way. It's a very much a samurai kind of feel to it, and there are also a couple of bits with samurai swords in it. But nowhere near the quality of this film. Peckinpah, between the alcohol and the drugs and the fucked up mind of the man, was on a decline when he made Killer Elite, which he hadn't quite reached that stage with Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. And if nothing else, I'm glad that he did the film, because it gave Warren Oates that one defining role that enables us to remember him fondly. And it's a real tragedy that Warren Oates died so early, because I'm sure there were any number of roles written after this, and there would have been roles written. Now, can you imagine what would have happened if Warren Oates had got together with a director like Quentin Tarantino, even though Oates would have been quite elderly? Can you imagine the kind of juxtaposition of those two people together in a movie? Would have been something spectacular. So that's about all I've got to say on the subject of Warren Mercer Oates. I think I'm going to do a few podcasts in the future where I look at the careers of single people rather than the way we've been doing the themes in the past. I've quite enjoyed this one, and I've enjoyed the research of it. I've enjoyed thinking about it, one actor rather than one style of movie, for a bit of a change. You've got to stay fresh. You've got to stay limber. And I'm going to take another break now, and then I'm going to get into the letters, and we'll finish off this little puppy.
Don't. Don't ever brag about what you do if you saw a ghost, or one will surely come. Don't slam the door because you might pinch some poor soul in it. Don't leave sharp knives lying around either, or some wandering spirit or ghost might get cut with them. Don't go looking over the graveyard wall. If you do, you will see ghosts. Don't laugh at ghosts. They are no joke. In Germany, they say don't bring an elder branch into the house because ghosts will come in with it. If ever you come upon an old hat or a piece of clothing lying on the ground with a stick across it, don't pick it up. The stick is a sign that it belongs to a ghost. Don't touch it. Don't yawn without covering your mouth with your hand. Ghosts are attracted by yawning. Some people say they will peer in and count your teeth or your fillings. But a very common belief in the world is that your soul can slip out when you yawn, and some ghost can slip in. If this happens, you will sicken and die. Don't ever speak to a ghost unless you really want it to answer, because ghosts have to answer as soon as spoken to.
Yes, we got letters this time around, and Mark Arlieba sent me one about psychoanalysis films. We're talking about the possibility of doing a podcast, of doing an overview of films about shrinks and psychoanalysis and things like that. And Mark threw in a couple of possibilities to look at for that podcast. Mark says the obvious choice is John Huston's Freud from 1962. A personal favourite of mine is Pressure Point from 1962, based on an actual case that Robert Lidner relates in his book The 50-Minute Hour. Sidney Poitier is a prison psychiatrist who analyses a neo-Nazi, Bobby Darin, includes surreal images of neo-Nazi dreams. Very powerful film if you can find it. Netflix has it in the US, so it must be available. And the other one was Ordinary People, 1980, is a good but may not have enough psychoanalysis for your purposes. Well, thanks for that, Mark. I'm compiling the list and checking it twice this time of year, of course. But appreciate the input on that one. I'm going to have to do it. It may take me a few podcasts to get around to it and do enough research to do justice to the subject. But I've got another one about this. David Munn, he talked about the most recent one, also talked a little bit about shrink flicks. Hi, Terry. I really enjoyed the latest episode. Gotta love that Pinter dialogue. I have to seek out Quiller Memorandum and the Spy Came In From the Cold. I think I saw a funeral in Berlin, but it was a very, very long time ago. On the subject of psychiatry and therapy in the movies, here are some of my favourites, other than Spellbound, of course. Suddenly Last Summer, 1959, a bit too over the top to be among Tennessee Williams' best plays, but as a piece of grand gothic, it's tremendously entertaining, and Montgomery Clift makes a suitably earnest psychiatrist. Not the only time he played one either, as he starred in John Huston's Freud in 1962, a film I've recently acquired but have not had time to watch, so there's another vote for Freud. W.R. Mysteries of the Organism, 1971, Yugoslavian director Dusan Makajevic. I got that wrong, but whatever. Arthouse Hodgepodge, tribute to Freud's most radical disowned disciple, Willem Reich. Is pure 70s counterculture, mixing a documentary account of Reich's life, work, ideas and discipline, with Thule Kufenberg singing Kill for Peace, a visit to the offices of Screw Magazine, The Art of Live Erect Penis Sculpting, I think that may be plastic casting, I'm not sure, footage from a Nazi pro-euthanasia film, Stalinist propaganda footage, a talking severed head, etc. There Might Be Giants, 1971, George C. Scott thinks he's Sherlock Holmes, and his psychiatrist Joanna Woodward is Dr. Watson. Yeah, definitely like They Might Be Giants. Haven't seen it for a long time, but I do like the film. The Ruined Class, 1972, Peter O'Toole thinks he's Jesus. Eventually he's cured, or is he? Again, another film I like. I haven't watched it all the way through recently, but I do have a copy of it. The Three Faces of Eve, 1957, Joanna Woodward suffers from multiple personality disorder. Cat People, 1942, can psychiatrist Tom Conway persuade Simone Simon that she isn't really a cat? Equus from 1977, Richard Burton tries to work out why Peter Firth blinded some horses. And of course, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975. And here are some that don't fit into the paleo cinema criteria, but are worth checking out anyway. Jean-Juan DeMarco, 1994. Ex-psychologist Jeremy Levin made a total mess of adapting his two brilliant novels to screen, Creator in 1985 and Crazy as Hell in 2002. But this film, which he not only scripted but also directed, is delightful. Johnny Depp plays a man who was hospitalised because he thinks he's Don Juan. Marlon Brando is a psychiatrist assigned to his case. Session 9, 2001. There are a lot of horror movies set in mental hospitals, but this one is unique. It's about a HazChem team cleaning the asbestos out of an abandoned asylum. One of them becomes fascinated by listening to some old session tapes, which turns out to be particularly sinister. Meanwhile, the other workers are starting to behave strangely. Psychiatric methods are very much the centre of this story. Colour of Night, 1994, a guilty pleasure if there ever was one. Richard Rush's last movie, which is a delicious slice of exploitation movie trash with Bruce Willis as a psychiatrist who blames himself for a patient's suicide. When a friend of his is murdered, he takes over the man's group therapy sessions, slowly realising that one of the group plans to kill him. He gets sexually involved with a mystery woman played by the lovely Jane March. Might be a sec, I'll just turn over the page to get the other side of this one. Can't wait to hear what movies you decide to cover next. It's always a pleasant surprise. Cheers, David. Thank you, David. They're a great list. I do like Colour of Night as well. Jane March is a bit spunky, and I think that Bruce Willis was very brave to have his dick on show in a film. A lot of Hollywood actors wouldn't have done that, but Bruce did, and all credit to him for that. It does give the women something to look at, and of course gay guys as well. So really appreciate the feedback on those ones. If there's anything else people want to see me do on Paleo Cinema, you know, apart from a live autopsy or something like that, which I won't do, always happy to oblige. So I'm keeping those, and we're going to add them to the podcast when we get around with it. I did get an email from Zachary Hobbs as well. Really love listening to the podcast and adding new titles to my Netflix queue each week. I'm only 30, so I have lots of catching up to do with, and your podcast is helping keep up the great work. Z, thanks for that, Zachary. Appreciate it, mate. It's all about sharing the love of the films, and not all of us can cover everything. I can't cover everything. I haven't seen everything. But the more we share amongst ourselves the stuff that we enjoy watching, the more viewing pleasure that everybody gets. Rickster, our old friend Rickster, a.k.a. Serps, sent a quick note as well. Just heard the latest podcast about a day after I sent you the email. Once again, a wonderful cast. I've never seen the films you discussed, but of course, now I'm very interested to catch them when I can. You're right, there's nothing quite like those Cold War movies. Once again, sorry I'm rather bored and don't have anything really interesting to add to the proceedings. The only thing I could possibly have to offer is in what way of a suggestion. How about favourite courtroom drama movies? There have been so many of them, including Anatomy of Murder, Inherit the Wind, To Kill a Mockingbird, Judgment in Nuremberg, and even Breaking Morant, which would be especially apropos considering the recent passing of Edward Woodward. Breaking Morant was from 1979 to 1980, wasn't it? That would just fall within the purview of Paleo Cinema, I think. Until then, I look forward to the wonderful podcast you have planned leading up to Newton Mass. Hope to write again soon on a more timely basis. All the best, Rick. P.S. Say hi to Sol for me. I love her hijacking the podcast a while ago when she lambasted you about the Rudy Ray Moore stuff. I don't share her opinion, but I loved it. Thanks for that, Rickster. Appreciate it. I'm trying to get Sol to pop in more often. She's a bit reluctant to because she's not quite the movie buff I am, and she feels a bit overwhelmed by it all at times, but I'll get her to come in and say hello for the Newton Mass podcast next time around. Do appreciate that. I also appreciate all of the feedback I've got through places like Facebook and the Twitter and all the other little bits and pieces that happen there. That's about all for this time around, guys and ladies. I don't get many emails from ladies, but I'm sure there are at least one or two around there. We're getting listeners in exotic places like southern Brazil and Ghana and various countries in Asia, including Indonesia, of course, as we've got a letter from a previous podcast, and Singapore, Japan and China, and all across Europe and the North American part of this clay and granite planet, and also Australia and New Zealand. So I appreciate the local feedback I'm getting from people. Keep it going. Keep the feedback coming. Keep me going, because it's so helpful to know that I'm not doing this in isolation, that I am being listened to and appreciated. Next time around, don't know what we're doing for Newton Mass, but I'll figure it out in the next couple of weeks. It will be up and running just before the reindeer shit on your roof. And that's about it for now. Enjoy your movie viewing. If you have any suggestions, please pass them on kultguru@gmail.com. And I will catch you guys on the flip side. Thank you.
Thank you.